Good morning, Your Honors. Denise Easton Kraft on behalf of Lexington Insurance Company, the defendant below, and appellee. With me at council table today is Alain Porterfield and Steve Pignano, who will be arguing on behalf of Lexington Insurance Company, my colleague and co-counsel.
Welcome.
May it please the court, John James from Potter, Anderson, and Caroon, representing the plaintiff below, appellant, Conagra Foods, Inc. And with me today, I have my co-counsel, Jonathan Cohen, and William Copley, both of whom have been admitted pro hoc vice, and Mr. Cohen will be presenting the argument again today.
Welcome to the court. Whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Jonathan Cohen, representing Conagra Foods. I've asked to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. This case is about whether an insurance policy obligates Lexington to pay for claims against Conagra arising from allegedly tainted peanut butter. Lexington doesn't dispute coverage under the policy. Instead, Lexington argues that Conagra never reaches that coverage because Conagra never satisfies the policy's retained limit. How much Conagra has to pay as a retained limit turns on the number of occurrences, as that term is used in the case. In the policy. If there's a single occurrence, Conagra has to pay a single $3 million retained limit, which it's done. If there are many occurrences, Conagra has to pay many retained limits totaling as much as $100 million or more before it can reach its coverage. The Superior Court held that there's a single occurrence under the policy's definition of occurrence and the aggregating provisions therein, which is consistent with this court's recent decision in the Stonewall versus DuPont case. The court went on, however, to hold that a different provision, the lot or batch provision, unambiguously overrides the definition of occurrence and the aggregating language therein, mandating a different result, multiple occurrences. The Superior Court is an error for three reasons. First, the Superior Court's interpretation can't be squared with the policy's terms or the cases that have interpreted similar terms in other insurance policies. Second, the Superior Court's interpretation is unreasonable in light of this court's precedents because it would eviscerate Conagra's insurance coverage. Third, even were the Superior Court's interpretation reasonable, it's not the sole reasonable interpretation because the two provisions can be harmonized so that the latter batch provision supplements rather than supplants the aggregating language and the definition of occurrence. And if there's if there are more than one reasonable interpretation, that means the policy is ambiguous and must be construed in favor of coverage and against Lexington, which admittedly drafted the endorsement.
On the latter point, yes. If hypothetically you're correct that there are this language is susceptible to two reasonable but differing interpretations, you automatically conclude that it should be resolved in favor of coverage?
Yes, under this court's decisions in Emmons and in Twin Cities versus Delaware Racing Association, both of which we cited in our brief, this court has interpreted ambiguities strictly against the insurance company. As it said in Emmons, confusing or convoluted language, particularly with respect to coverage limiting positions, is to be interpreted against the insurer. Delaware Racing talked about four criteria under which justified that result without going to extrinsic evidence. The first was that the insurer drafted the provision, which they admit that they've done here. The second is that they could have used language which was clear and unambiguous, but didn't. The third is that there were cases at the time that the policy was written which interpret language and thus the insurer is deemed to be aware of the case law at the time the policy was written. Here, there were three cases on this issue at the time the policy was written, and all three of them reject Lexington's interpretation. And then the fourth criterion that the court applied is that there was no extrinsic evidence put before the lower court by the insurer, and so the insurer took the position that there was no extrinsic evidence that was necessary.
Is that the case here?
All four of those are the case here, Your Honor, yes.
The Superior Court found that there was a single occurrence?
The Superior Court found there was a single occurrence under the definition of occurrence.
All right. But that occurrence would then be balkanized into 7-day increments?
That's what the Superior Court held, based on its holding that the Lauter-Batch provision overrides the definition.
The answer is yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we, in effect, have not a single occurrence, but multiple occurrences each for 7 days?
That's what the Superior Court held, but we think the Superior Court was in error, Your Honor.
Okay. And without getting into the niceties of the legal analysis, your position is that there is one occurrence. It's not the occurrence is not subdivided by 7 day increments or any increments at all. Correct.
Correct.
And what gets you there?
The definition of occurrence tells you what an occurrence is: an accident or repeated exposure to similar harmful conditions. This court, that's the starting point. This court held in Stonewall what that means, which is that it's an aggregating provision, and under facts like this, the Superior Court correctly said that would mean one occurrence. You then go to the Lauter-Batch provision and ask whether that unambiguously mandates a different result. And the answer is no for at least two reasons. The first is the Lauter-Batch provision tells you what it amends. It amends the limits of insurance section of the policy. It says the limits of insurance is amended to include the following language. And then it tells you expressly that all other terms and definitions, that is, other than the limits of insurance, remain unchanged, including the definition of occurrence. The second place that you look is the operative language of the Lauter-Batch provision, which tells you that with respect to certain claims, it has a deemer provision similar to the second provision to the second sentence in the definition of occurrence, which this court interpreted in Stonewall. It says all injury arising out of a single Lauter-Batch constitutes a single occurrence. But it doesn't go on to say what happens if there are multiple Lauter-Batches. It doesn't say it overrides the definition of occurrence. It doesn't provide an alternative definition of occurrence. Instead, on its face, it's solely a coverage-enhancing provision. And as a result, had Lexington intended this to have a different meaning, had Lexington intended this to essentially supplant the definition of occurrence and the aggregating effect that this court held in Stonewall, they were obligated under Emmons and under the Delaware Racing Association case to do it expressly and clearly. If they didn't do it that way, then it has to be interpreted against them.
So the critical, the most critically disputed but essential portion of your side's position and argument is that the lot or batch provision is ambiguous. Is that right?
Your Honor, we believe that it's unambiguous
right?
in our favor, but
is
you don't need...
Right? That the ambiguity of the lot or batch provision is critical to your case?
No, because we think it's not ambiguous in our favor in the first instance, but you don't have to go that far. If you hold that it's ambiguous, you need to interpret it in favor of coverage. But we don't think it's ambiguous in the first place. We think it can only be construed as an enhancement to coverage and not to supplant or override the definition of occurrences.
You're aberration. Making alternative arguments.
Correct, Your
Honor.
Your
first argument is it's unambiguous and your position prevails. Your second argument is if it is ambiguous based on our prior cases, it should be construed in favor of you and you prevail alternatively.
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, it appears what no one wants is to focus on the fact that this is summary judgment and send it back for a proceeding about presenting extrinsic evidence and ascertaining the intent of the parties. You want this resolved as a matter of law in this appeal on one of your two theories.
That's correct, but Your Honor, if you were to conclude that you needed to send it back for extrinsic evidence, we would further argue that we are at least entitled to defense costs under those circumstances. Because the standard for that is it's even arguable that there's coverage. There's no dispute that we would have satisfied the retained limit under one reasonable interpretation of the policy. So, yes, Your Honor, we believe that this case can be resolved as a matter of law, but to the extent that this court disagrees with us, we think if it's sent back, it ought to be sent back subject to Lexington being obliged to pay defense costs.
So if you win on your first two theories, you're going to get defense costs. And if it goes back on the third theory, you get defense costs with the merits to be decided after discovery and further proceedings.
Correct, Your Honor. And this is the result that all the other courts who have considered this case have come with these types of provisions have come to. There are three cases in particular. Lafarge, which was decided by the Federal District Court and then the decision adopted by the Fourth Circuit. There were 1,900 lots or batches. That wasn't disputed. And so there was no question there about whether there was a lot or batch or how many there were. But the court said that it was clearly unreasonable to interpret the provision that said all injury arising from a single lot constitutes a single occurrence to mean that if there were two lots or batches, that inevitably resulted in two occurrences.
But in Lafarge and the other cases that you cite, yes. Were the lot and batch provisions similar to the one in the incident case? For example, was there a time limit in the lot and batch?
The operative provisions were virtually identical. The time limit that you're referring to is in the definition of lot or batch. And there are two separate questions. The first is, what is a lot or batch? And how many are there? The second question is, what's the connection between whether there are lots of batches, how many there are, and the number of occurrences? The other cases I'm referring to started from there are multiple lots or batches, so they didn't really analyze the question of what's a lot or a batch. Just as here, if you were to conclude that the Superior Court's interpretation of the definition of lot or batch were correct, which we don't think it is, but if you were to conclude that, then you'd say there were many lots or batches, and then this case and Lafarge, Diamond Shamrock, and Union Carbide would be indistinguishable.
Okay, so the ruling from which your side is appealing is basically number of lots or batches equals number of occurrences.
Exactly right, Your Honor.
And your position is that equation is wrong. There is no connect between the number of lots or batches and the number of occurrences. Is that right?
Correct.
That's your primary position.
Correct. To say that differently, there's the only connection in the lot or batch provision is if all injury arises from one lot, then there's one occurrence, regardless of how many there would have been under the definition of occurrence. But it doesn't go the other direction. For instance, if there was a single explosion at a plant, and that explosion put debris into three lots of product that were sitting there, that would still be one occurrence because it was one accident. The happenstance of whether there was one lot sitting in the factory, three lots, or 50 lots wouldn't affect the number of occurrences and the number of retained limits.
Of course, I think the other side would say, but what happens if you have one explosion that recurs every 7 days, all arising out of the same cause?
To the extent that would be multiple occurrences, it would be because the seven explosions or the multiple explosions, I can't remember your hypothetical, each constitute a separate accident under the definition of occurrence. The question then would become, is there any additional aggregation? Under seven individual explosions, you'd have to have seven $3 million retained limits under the general liability. That's $21 million, subject to a $9 million aggregate limit cap, which, incidentally, the schedule of retained limits says expressly applies to products completed operations claims, which they claim, I think the linchpin of their argument, is inconsistent with the idea that this would be the only provision that provides aggregation with respect to products completed operations claims.
The cases that you're relying on, do they go to your primary argument, that is, that it's a misinterpretation?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
That is the only legally correct interpretation.
That is correct. Lafarge says it as clearly as can be. It says that the interpretation that eviscerates coverage by breaking up that single occurrence, it says, is clearly unreasonable. Okay. And then it rejects it for that reason.
So they don't go off on ambiguity.
No, they do not find it ambiguous. They find it unambiguous, contrary to the way that the Superior Court interpreted it.
Are the circumstances surrounding the endorsement in dispute at all?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. In the October 6, 2010 hearing, which we gave you a transcript of, at page 23, line 14 and 15, Lexington states that it drafted the endorsement.
And there's no other relevant circumstance, according to either side?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And so the other question is, how does this policy work as a whole? Because fundamentally, we believe that if you were to read this case like the Superior Court, read the policy as the Superior Court did, you would not only need to read into the provision things that aren't there, things like this is an alternative definition of occurrence, but you'd also read out of the policy things that are there, like the retained limit schedule I referred to before. And so this case to us comes down to the question of, is there anything that it unambiguously supplants the definition of occurrence? And we respectively say that there's not. One of the issues that the Superior Court seemed troubled by is whether the harmonious interpretation that I'm proposing, that these two provisions can be read in harmony, that one supplements rather than supplants, the Superior Court was troubled as to whether that would somehow render the lot or batch provision superfluous. We respectively say it does not. It does mean that it doesn't have an application in this case, but that doesn't make it superfluous. There could be facts under which, even after Stonewall, this court were to conclude that the definition of occurrence doesn't provide sufficient aggregation to aggregate to one occurrence. There was a recent case, for instance, in New York in the federal district court there called Bausch & Lomb versus Lexington Insurance Company, the same insurer, 679 F sup 2nd 345, where the issue was contact lens solution. And contact lens solution, it hadn't been tainted or contaminated, but different people had a different reaction to it.
Is it cited in the briefs?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
Did you disclose it to the other side before?
No, we have not discussed this case, Your Honor. But I think just the facts of it are a useful example, because where the court came to is that there were multiple occurrences which defeated coverage. My point is solely that if there were facts where there were multiple occurrences under the definition of occurrence, this provision enables ConAgra to still access its coverage. But in exchange for that additional aggregation, it has to pay a almost twice as high per occurrence retained limit. So it has to pay $5 million instead of $3 million. And that makes all of these provisions work together. So if there are no other questions on that set of issues, I'd like to turn to the second question, which I referred to earlier, which is how many lots or batches are there, or are there lots or batches? Which is an alternative argument. We believe, as I said before, that the number of lots or batches is irrelevant because of the way that the policy is interpreted, should be interpreted with respect to the number of occurrences. But we also think there are no lots or batches here. A lot or batch is defined in this policy to be a single production run at a single facility, not to exceed a 7-day period. What the Superior Court said is that a single production run at a single facility that in fact exceeds 7 days is more than one lot or batch. We believe that what that language should properly be interpreted to mean, and it's at least reasonable to read it this way in our view, is that the entirety of the single production run has to be under 7 days, and that if it's not under 7 days, then there simply is no lot or batch, which is another way of stopping ConAgra from having too much extra aggregation, which is, again, our view of the purpose of this provision. Lexington has argued that what that language actually means, and the language they use in their brief, is that each period of production, not to exceed 7 days, is a separate lot or batch. Again, to the extent that that's what they meant, they could have and were obligated to use that type of language here. Because they didn't, it's at least reasonable to interpret the lot or batch definition to require the entirety of the production run to be within the 7 day, to be within 7 days, or else there simply is no lot or batch.
Your position is, as I understand it, that the endorsement was intended to expand the coverage.
Correct, Your Honor.
Was an additional premium paid for the endorsement?
I don't believe that was negotiated, Your Honor, because I believe that the policy was presented by the insurer with the endorsement. But there's no evidence in the record on that, as far as I know.
The endorsement was at your client's request?
No, Your Honor. The endorsement was part of the policy that Lexington had drafted and gave to the policyholder. Lexington drafted the endorsement. I don't believe there's any evidence in the record with respect to who asked for the endorsement beyond the fact that Lexington drafted it and provided it to the insured.
Well, it may be counterintuitive, but you're telling us that the endorsement increased the coverage?
Correct, Your Honor.
So you're telling us Lexington said, here's a policy, and by the way, we want you to know we've added this endorsement to increase your coverage.
Insurers compete very diligently for the business of a company like ConAgra. They provide companies like ConAgra with policies telling them these are the bells and whistles that we can provide. And our product is better than other people's products because in this competitive environment, we want you to buy our product.
Well, is it fair to say we're getting into drafting history and negotiations now with no record to support
assumptions
we're being asked to infer?
I think that's right, except that the language of the provision itself provides only an aggregating statement. It only says injuries arising out of a single lot or batch is a single occurrence. It doesn't, that language in and of itself is susceptible to only the interpretation, in our view, only reasonable interpretation, that it's an aggregating provision that enhances coverage. And at the very least, if that's a reasonable interpretation, then the policy is at least ambiguous.
I understand that. My only point is we're at the stage of this case where it doesn't matter who presented the endorsement, whether it was an additional cost and over a basic premium or not. This is simply about the language of the policy and the endorsement.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. I see that I'm out of time. I'd like to reserve.
You want to save the rest?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Stephen Prignano for the appellee Lexington Insurance Company. Your Honors, Lexington's position in this matter is very simply that the lot or batch endorsement, endorsement 3 to this policy, determines the number of occurrences for the peanut butter claims and not some other provision of the policy. And under that endorsement, an occurrence is no longer than 7 days of production. The endorsement begins with the language, this policy is amended as follows, and it amends the limits of insurance section of the policy. And then it goes on to explain in clear terms, quote, all bodily injury arising out of one lot or batch of products prepared or acquired by you shall be considered one occurrence. Now, occurrence, therefore, is contractually linked to the term lot or batch. The two are joined together. An occurrence is set equal to all bodily injury claims arising out of a lot or batch, and it does that with the word shall, the imperative shall. That language we would submit, as Judge Silverman found, is unambiguous. So that claims, that bodily injury claims that arise from a lot or batch of products will be an occurrence.
But your position is really moving upstream against Union Carbide, Diamond Shamrock, and Lafarge, isn't it?
Well, let me take each of those cases, Your Honor. In Union Carbide, the court said there were issues of fact around the question of the lot or batch endorsement and didn't rest its decision on that endorsement in that case. In Diamond Shamrock, the court said that the lot or batch endorsement would not apply to claims of a design defect, but it stated expressly in its decision at page 247, 609 Atlantic 2nd, that the lot or batch endorsement would apply to claims involving products that were manufactured and non-conforming. It said expressly that it would apply the endorsement to those claims. That brings us to finally to Lafarge. Lafarge had different language, different lot or batch language. Here we have an express temporal limitation, defined limitation, on the size of a lot or batch that was absent in the Lafarge case. There's a clear intention expressed in this endorsement to limit occurrences for claims arising from a lot or batch to 7-day increments. That was completely absent in Lafarge. And there was another very important distinction in Lafarge. Lafarge said that the lot or batch endorsement in that case could only apply where there's a single lot or batch. If there were more than one lot or batches, the court said the endorsement just simply would not apply. Here, the policy is explicit that there can be more than one occurrence arising from the lot or batch endorsement. In endorsement 10 of the policy, the schedule of retained limits, which describes the retained limit for lot or batch coverage, it says expressly, lot or batch coverage up to 7 days, U.S. $5 million per occurrence without aggregate. Per occurrence here means there can be more than one occurrence for lot or batch coverage. Without aggregate means there's no limit to the number of occurrences there could be for lot or batch coverage. That is completely absent in the Lafarge case. There was no discussion of a similar provision in that case. So under this lot or batch provision, There can be more than one lots or batches that give rise to more than one occurrence. And that's exactly what Judge Silverman found, and we submit the language with respect to that is very clear.
Well, your premise is that that's the only interpretation that's permissible.
That's correct, Your Honor. We
but
think that
if
it's
there
the
is another one, then contra proferendum would apply.
If there is another reasonable interpretation, Your Honor, which we dispute, but if there were to be another reasonable interpretation, we do not think that the doctrine of contra proferentum would be appropriate to apply if the language was negotiated between the parties. When I was here last time, I did say that the endorsement was written by Lexington, and that's accurate. It was written by Lexington. However, I also mentioned that the parties have exchanged discovery per order of Judge Silverman, and Lexington did produce portions of its underwriting file. That discovery had already been underway at the time the decision came out. But if this court were to conclude that there was an ambiguity, we would urge the court not to apply contra proferendum, but at least allow Lexington the opportunity to demonstrate that this language was negotiated. We believe that based on the discovery that's been already supplied, it will reveal that the seven-day language, which is unique from the other cases that we've been able to find, was specifically negotiated between the parties.
Let's follow that through so I'll understand, you know, what would happen on the ground, you know, if we were to go that route. If we were to find that there was an ambiguity, I take it that you are arguing that the case should then be remanded for the court to take evidence on whether or not there really was ambiguity. And if there was, that is, if the trial court finds that there was ambiguity, there's an additional question of whether this particular insurance contract was in fact negotiated. If it was negotiated, then contra preferentum doesn't apply, and the court then decides, based on the evidence, what the parties intended. Is that right?
Yes, one option is to pursue the party's intent, and in the event that...
And if the court finds that there really is an ambiguity, then contra preferentum... I'm sorry, that there wasn't negotiation or there wasn't a real negotiation... between two parties with equal bargaining strength, then there would be a contra preferendum result.
Our position would be that if the evidence revealed that the provision was negotiated by the parties, that contra preferentum would not be appropriate to resolve an ambiguity in the agreement, that the court could consider the evidence of the party's intent where the evidence shows that the language was specifically negotiated.
Right. But if it wasn't specifically negotiated, then there would be a contra preferendum.
And let me follow that for a moment. If there was an ambiguity and it was not negotiated, I believe the law that has been laid down by this court is that ambiguities are resolved against the carrier. However, in this case, if that were done, if, let's say, the seven-day language were deemed to operate the way ConAgra says it operates, it has to be a production run of less than 7 days to be a lotter batch. That factual issue has never been determined in this case. Whether a ConAgra manufactures in a continuous production run or a production run of under 7 days has never been determined. Judge Silverman, for purposes of the motion, simply gave ConAgra the benefit of the doubt on that issue. But it's never been determined in this case. So even if the court resolved this language against us, we should still be permitted the opportunity to find out exactly how ConAgra does manufacture its product.
You're saying that Judge Silverman just assumed the seven-day equation without deciding it?
He assumed factually that ConAgra produces in a continuous production run that exceeds 7 days for purposes of the motion. And all I'm saying is that since he's done that, that issue has never been resolved in this case. But our primary position is that this language is not ambiguous, that if there is more than one lot or batch for these claims, that necessarily means there is more than one occurrence. The endorsement, we think, is clear when it uses the word shall and contractually links occurrence to lot or batch, that becomes the definition of occurrence for these claims. the endorsement then goes on to define what is a lot or batch, and it does it using a temporal limitation. It states, for purposes of this endorsement, lot or batch is defined as a single production run at a single facility, not to exceed a 7-day period.
Now, but then if there's a continuous run and that exceeds 7 days, why does that definition apply? You know, the argument in the brief is, by definition, once we have a continuous run that exceeds 7 days, we're talking about a different part of the policy and we only have to pay $3 million.
Because I think that Conagra is reading limiting language into the phrase that I just read to achieve the result that they state. The language that I just read does not say that the entirety of the production run must be less than 7 days in order to be a lot or batch. That's the word that Mr. Cohen just used. That word entirety or total production run is not in the language. If you have a period of production of 7 days or less, everyone agrees that that would be a lot or batch under this language, and all claims arising from that lot or batch would be an occurrence.
So what the result, though, is that if you have continuous run and it's a lot or batch that exceeds 7 days, with this endorsement, you've changed your coverage to basically having coverage in 7-day increments, and you've changed the amount you pay from $3 million to $5 million for every 7-day increment.
And that is the coverage that Conagra purchased. They purchased a policy that added this coverage, added these limitations in this coverage as an endorsement. This endorsement was added to the policy. They bought, essentially, coverage for claims of mass-produced consumer food products that covers them in increments of 7 days. There could be enormous claims arising from a period of 7 days of production. It would not stretch the imagination to think that they could exceed a $5 million retained limit for any period of that 7 days for these mass-produced consumer food products. But if you have a period that extends over 7 days, the definition of this endorsement that I just read is still satisfied. If you had 14 days, you will have a period of 7 days that satisfies the definition, and you will have another period of 7 days that satisfies the definition. The language of the endorsement places no restriction on the total length of a production run. What it describes is the length of a lot or batch, and therefore an occurrence.
Does our decision in Stonewall have any effect on this case?
We think not, because Stonewall covers an interpretation of the general definition of occurrence that we believe has been replaced for these claims by the lot or batch endorsement here. The lot or batch endorsement sets an occurrence equal to a lot or batch, not a common cause, as Stonewall found with the general definition of occurrence. For these claims, this endorsement amends the policy. It specifically addresses an occurrence. It sets it equal to a lot or batch.
So then what we have is both parties agree in this case, but for the endorsement, this would be covered as an occurrence. Your argument is, because of the endorsement, it's not covered, and their argument is, no, it's still covered.
Our argument is, that's correct. Our argument is that if there's not a lot or batch for these claims under this endorsement, there's no coverage for these claims under the endorsement, and that's why we think their interpretation of this language makes no sense, because they would say, if it goes over 7 days, there's no occurrence. Well, if there's no occurrence under this endorsement, our position is there's no coverage, because this is the only portion of the policy that specifically provides coverage for products manufactured in a facility in a production run. And if the definition of occurrence is not satisfied for these claims, there's no coverage under the policy. Now, that is not what we think to be a reasonable result coming from their interpretation of the language. The interpretation that Judge Silverman adopted reads the language of the endorsement together and creates coverage even if the production run extends beyond 7 days. And
we agree. I'm sorry. Tell us what the limits of coverage are for each occurrence.
Our limits are $25 million, and defense costs are in addition to that and outside the limit. So
for each occurrence?
That's an aggregate.
Okay.
Each occurrence and $25 million aggregate as well. Plus, as I say, defense costs. We contend that the limits of the self-insured retention are $5 million per occurrence.
Right, so if you have five occurrences, basically the coverage is, all it does is reimburse the insured for the retainage, correct, for the deductible.
Well, our position would be if there are five occurrences, they would have five SIRs to satisfy before getting to our coverage.
If you had five occurrences, the total available insurance would be $25 million.
$25 million as an aggregate. That's correct.
Right, and but it would cost the company $5 million or $25 million, excuse me, of deductibles to get there. To get that $25 million
for five occurrences,
yeah.
For five occurrences, there being no aggregate for the retention. In any event, I think if
I'd like to ask you on the reference to earlier to extrinsic evidence, was that pointed out to the Superior Court judge?
Specifically, I know that Judge Silverman ordered discovery. There was, I do not recall to what extent negotiations were discussed. I do recall during the hearing that it was noted that the 7-day provision appeared to be unique in that there were no other decided cases that addressed similar language. And I think Judge Silverman made the comment at the hearing that that would lead one to believe that it was perhaps negotiated. I think that may have been what caused him to order the discovery, but that discovery was already in process. We know from our own files and the materials that we produce that, in fact, was, which is why we think that we ought to have an opportunity to demonstrate a negotiation before the court were to conclude that contra pro forensum should apply.
But were there, refresh my memory on this, were there cross motions for summary judgment?
There were.
And did you, in response to the cross motion for summary judgment, say that if, in the event the Superior Court was inclined to order summary judgment for ConAgra, that it should not because there was evidence of negotiation?
No, because ConAgra's motion was more limited. ConAgra simply moved on the duty to defend. Our motion was one on the merits of coverage. We moved for a declaration that ConAgra had not exceeded the self-insured retention. Their motion was more limited. ConAgra simply said we had a duty to defend because there's a chance that coverage could have been impacted. So in response to that motion, it wasn't necessary to get further into the language, but our motion certainly put the language before the court, and the position that we've always taken and we still take today is that the language is clear. If there are no other questions, I think I will just sum up and indicate that the endorsement, this endorsement, not some other provision of the policy, specifically defines an occurrence for the lot or batch claims, and it defines the occurrence as a lot or batch, claims arising from a lot or batch of 7-day increments. We think the language is clear and unambiguous and that it was correctly applied by Judge Silverman. We further believe that ConAgra has not shown an exhaustion of the retained limit, and therefore the judgment of the Superior Court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Your Honors, I would like to make 3 points in rebuttal. First, you all asked Mr. Pignano about what exactly would be at issue were there to be a remand after a finding of ambiguity at this court. And I wanted to clarify that in the first instance, the question of ambiguity wouldn't itself be an issue for remand. But the question would be, is there extrinsic evidence that answers that ambiguity, that resolves it? it's not just contra preferentum that makes it so that if there remains ambiguity, it should be interpreted against the insurer. This is a coverage limiting provision, as they're arguing, and they have the burden of proof to the extent that they want to establish that there should be less coverage.
There is extrinsic evidence, as the other side has indicated, on negotiation.
The court had not had discovery when it ruled on this issue. We, ConAgra, requested discovery, and after the hearing on summary judgment, the court granted limited discovery on certain limited issues. That discovery is not in the record here, Your Honor.
Mr. Cohen, I believe in your opening statement, you argued that your alternative position was that the entirety of the production would have to be in 7 days or less.
Correct.
And if, as you contend here, the production exceeded 7 days, then there was, in effect, no lot or batch.
Correct, Your Honor.
The response to that argument is, well, if there's no lot or batch, there's no occurrence, and if there's no occurrence, there's no coverage.
We disagree with that position because the definition of occurrence and Stonewall still rules the question of how there would be, of what is an occurrence. If you want to know what an occurrence is under a contract, you look at the definition of occurrence, and that tells you what it is. The question is there anything in the lot or batch provision that changes that? If the lot or batch provision doesn't apply, either because of our first argument that it's solely coverage enhancing, or our second argument that there's no lot or batch, then the definition of occurrence still stands strong, and the case is ruled by the Stonewall decision.
I want to follow up on your point that yeah. discovery is not in the record. What do you mean by that? You mean that it's not been filed with the court? There has been discovery and information exchanged showing that there was negotiation.
No, Your Honor. The judge below ordered discovery at the close of the summary judgment hearing, but there is nothing. And some limited discovery had been exchanged by the parties, but none of that discovery has been in the record, and the court never had any reason to look at that discovery before issuing its decision.
I understand you. So it hasn't been filed?
It hasn't been filed or referred to by the parties in any pleading.
Okay. But it exists, showing that there is evidence of negotiation of this endorsement.
I have not reviewed that discovery to be able to tell you what's in it or not, Your Honor. Because the court decided this case before we had an opportunity to conclude the exchanges. So I don't know the answer to your question.
The one thing we do know is that the court didn't rely on that discovery for the purpose of the summary judgment motion.
Correct. That is certain, Your Honor. I also wanted to respond to Mr. Pignano's attempt to distinguish the Lafarge, Diamond Shamrock, and Union Carbide case. Mr. Pignano refers to the schedule of retained limits to try to explain how the lot or batch provision can be the only provision that provides the definition of occurrence with respect to product completed operations claims. But at page A526 of the record, where the schedule of retained limits is, you'll see with respect to the lot or batch coverage, it requires $5 million per occurrence. But the general liability coverage, which would apply if it's aggregated under the definition of occurrence, says it's got a $3 million per occurrence, $9 million general aggregate, and, quote, products completed operations aggregate combined. So it does. So to read the policy the way that Lexington does, that the lot or batch coverage retained limit is the only one that can apply to products completed operations claims, reads out of the policy that provision that I just read. Similarly, they refer to Diamond Shamrock case and say that case is limited to, I think they said, design defects. But what that case says is that one thing is clear. This provision is there to enhance, to increase coverage, not to limit it. Your Honor, as I see that I'm out of time, thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.